From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Shake it, don't break it. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Well, if you took what looks like a very pleasant fetishized package, but actually the undercurrents are Pasolini, Bresson, and Dreyer. That's what my guest writer, director, and sometimes actress Annabella does with her films. She starred in the film, which she also wrote and directed and designed and did the costumes for, Viva. Her newest film is writer-director, which is now on home video. Please see it. It's The Love Witch. First of all, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And when I saw The Love Witch, I couldn't help but think about the passion of Joan of Arc and the trials of Joan of Arc. I mean, it seemed to be pitched somewhere between those two movies with, of course, the sort of the visual aesthetic of Douglas Sirk.
That's such so great that you say that, because in interviews, I'm always talking about how influenced I've been by Carl Dreyer, and everybody always seems incredibly shocked, and they like as if they don't believe me. The Dreyer film that most inspired The Love Witch was actually Gertrude,
okay.
And because it's very similar themes. It's a woman who is actually spiritually superior to her suitors. So they're unable to love, no matter how much, you know, they get love potions and, you know, everything, you know, sexually excited by her and everything. They just can't, they don't have the capacity to love the way she does. So this is actually, Gertrude was the first root of inspiration for making this movie. It's also very inspired by Day of Wrath. And also by Passion of Joan of Arc. But you're actually the very first person who's seen that in the film.
That can't be possible. Okay.
and obviously Douglas Sirk for the color and the melodrama, but also even more, I would say the color films of Hitchcock, the melodramatic thrillers from the early 60s, late 50s.
Yeah, like Vertigo and certainly, but also there seems to be a bit of Psycho there as well. Is there
Vertigo, that? Psycho, Marnie.
Marnie, yeah,
the birds, but I also find myself thinking
of Pasolini's Arabian Nights.
Absolutely, Pasolini. Everything by Pasolini.
But Arabian Nights in particular, especially sort of the Renaissance fair aspect and all that.
Oh, yeah. Well, everything by Pasolini has been such a big inspiration for me because of his the realness, just the, how it gets down into things that are so psychologically real and human through fantasy. And that's exactly what I like to do.
Well, talk, if you can tell the audience a little bit what The Love Witch is about, just because we're talking about all these points of reference, let's let them know what they're going to be seeing.
Well, The Love Witch is a feature film. It was shot on 35mm, and it was...
And I saw it in a movie theater here in Los Angeles, and it looked beautiful.
Yeah, and I caught an original negative, so what you saw was printed from the original negative. And it's about a young, beautiful witch who wants to get love into her life, and so she uses magic. But the magic isn't supernatural. It's this idea that if she gives men everything they want and she becomes their perfect fantasy, this is the way she can get love from them. But it kind of backfires. And so the movie really is about the misunderstandings between men and women.
Which is also what Viva's about.
Yeah, exactly. It's about the different desires that men and women have and how they don't see eye to eye and how women can really be crushed down by living in a man's world. You know, it's sort of like both movies, Viva and The Love Witch, are about how women can sort of twist themselves in knots, trying to please men, but it doesn't work because it's really their own will they're trying to establish, and that's what doesn't work in a man's world.
Yes, absolutely. And because of the costuming, and by the way, I'm wearing a vintage Poochie shirt just for you.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's a pink shirt, and you pull it off so well. Gorgeous.
I like to say, if I could blush, I would. But I think what's interesting is because you use this kind of visual stylization that brings to mind the 60s, even though they're modern films. Rather, The Love Witch is a modern film, basically.
Yeah, well, I'm just using different tools of cinema than people use now. And, you know, the way I think of it is some people don't understand that. They think, well, it's a parody or it's a pastiche of the older type of cinema. And what I would say to that is like, well, what if, let's just take... you know, a scenario in which what if people had stopped playing jazz and it was only rock and roll? What if jazz had replaced rock and roll? I mean, rock and roll had replaced jazz and there was no more jazz. And then somebody played jazz, like there was a group and it played jazz. And everybody said, it's a parody of jazz. It's a pastiche of jazz. It's making fun of jazz. That's only in the minds or the eyes of the people who don't like jazz. You know, the people who are making the jazz, they have reverence for jazz and they love jazz, but what they're doing is they're using a different set of tones and chords and harmonizations and relationships than, you know, that are more complex, actually. But it's a different thing. It's just a different thing.
Or also the people who don't know jazz and are always thinking, well, this must be a pastiche because I've heard about this jazz, but I've never really heard it before.
A little bit like that. So it's sort of like I have such reverence for classic cinema. It's all I ever watch. So I don't understand, you know, how I could be making a parody of it. What I'm trying to do is I learn from it. You know, I just learn from all the classic cinema. Like, I just think, what cinema is breathtaking? What moves me? What excites me? And, you know, some of the cinema you mentioned, Pasolini, Dreyer, the great classic Hollywood cinema, pre-code and noir and the melodramas and thrillers. And all this, the cinema was so intelligent, but mainly what it was it was constructed completely consciously.
And well, it had to be because there's so many things that couldn't be said in those films. The post-code films, the pre-code films were very much about sort of how sexual freedom kind of ruined women because they were too modern for the era in which they lived.
That's right. But I also mean just constructed in terms of just the construction of the sets, the costumes, the lighting. And I noticed, you know, early on that one thing that really excited me about classic movies was the lighting, especially the black and white movies. It's the contrast and it's the shimmer, especially the old nitrate movies.
Using my silver nitrate prints.
Yeah, and just wanting to replicate that kind of depth, in the lighting. You know, HD is very flat. You know, digital cameras make a very flat image and they try to add, you know, stuff later to make it more interesting. But if they would light it, it wouldn't be as flat. I mean, you actually see some beautiful things shot on video because they're lit, because you don't have to light it, then people don't light it. It's sort of a laziness. But, you know, the whole art of cinematography used to be trying to create, you know, take your two-dimensional screen and make it more like three dimensions. So I learned very early on when I was shooting my very first short films that lighting was the main thing. And so I went through a whole lot of DPs trying to find people I could have.
And nobody knows how to shoot like that because you use so much light. As you were talking about this, you remind me of the story of Garbo, who could always tell when her close-up was perfect because she could tell by the heat on her face from the light.
Yeah, and the actors on my sets too, you know, they have that hot light hitting them, and they feel like they're on a stage, and they feel like they're a star. It enhances their performance. You know, it makes everything supercharged. They're not just a regular person in a room. The spotlight's on them. But also just the way it brings out color. You know, the color in films today is so gray, and that's partly because there's not enough light to bring out the color. You need to put a lot of light, even on digital, I think, to get that kind of color.
But it's funny because we're talking about, by the way, it's The Treatment. My guest is the very talented writer, director, creator, I should say, of the films Viva and her newest film, The Love Witch. They're both on home video. Even the sort of neorealism, the Italian films are like suffused with light. I mean, they really use light. So even though they were like basically made to look like found footage, they still look like movies.
Well, they had to just to get an exposure. I mean, the films were much lower speed back then. And so even very documentary-like films, you know, there was a ton of light. So there was a lot of contrast. You know, people think of noir films as being dark, but they weren't dark. They were also bright. They were contrasty. They were dark and light. And people's faces were bathed in light. They were glowing with light. And it's just that the shadows were deep. And that's what film can do. It's beautiful.
Who are some of your favorite cinematographers? As we're talking, I just can't help but think of the Magnificent Ambersons and the use of light in that film.
I mean, I'm not sort of like a kind of a person who knows everybody's name, you know.
But
James Wong Howe, and
course,
I love Jack Cardiff. And so there are a few people whose names I know. And, you know, and I love John Alton, you know, who did, you know, poured through his book, you know, trying to learn the language of cinematography and lighting so I can discuss it with DPs, you know.
Well, this is the way a painter thinks as compared to...
Well, I used to be a painter. And I was always trying to get more... It was weird because I couldn't really see volume. My paintings were flat. So there's this thing about... I grew up... My dad's a painter. So I grew up looking at so much Matisse because it was his favorite painter that when I started painting, I saw in terms of flat color. And there was this way in which I couldn't get out of that and to do, you know, everything was in the front. So, you know, and I love that kind of painting, actually, but for some reason I wasn't able to get out of it because it was the first stuff I saw and it was the most influential in my way of seeing. So when I went into film, I sort of still do film that way in a weird way, like everything's bright. But I like to create, I also like to create shadows.
You create dimension. It's not flat in that way that stylized flatness of Matisse.
But I like the idea of having these blocks of color, the way painting is, you know, like these. So when I design the sets, I design them on paper first. I paint them with blocks of color. So it's all blocks of color. And then when I, you know, when I'm finding the objects and things, you know, a real upholster furniture or make bedspreads or curtains or things, and they're all with those blocks of color. And this is what makes the film seem so designed.
Because it is designed.
And this is what makes it feel like Douglas Sirk or something, because, you know, in those 50s films, they usually had sets in no more than two or three colors, and oftentimes they were monochromatic, just all in light blue, or the whole set would be gold. And this would create this kind of harmony in the set, you know, and then the actors could have accents. So it's like this way of designing, you're thinking about either characters blending or characters popping. And it's still all about the actors and the story, like the emotion, you know, carrying actors through a story with color, color emotion.
It's fascinating to me because I think that it's a very modern story, Love Witch told with the tools of classic cinema. Mm-hmm. So because of those visual cues that people get and because of the formality of the compositions, I mean, so many of these are like portraits almost, mm-hmm. that people don't know how to separate them. So they take their cues from the visual rather than taking in the whole picture, which must be a little frustrating for you.
It is frustrating because I think maybe on one viewing, people are astonished by the look of it, and so they don't get the story. So sometimes they don't understand that there is a story. But, you know, people who watch a lot of classic movies, they don't have that problem with it. They just take in the story because it's the kind of they're used to being told a story in that way, and so they grasp the plot the first time around.
But so much of what people are obsessed with nowadays, too, though, is like 60s and 70s cinema, which is a break from the kind of classicism that we're mm-hmm. talking about. And whereas some of the 60s films, even to the early 70s, Russ Meyer or Radley Metzger used that kind of visual stylization. Mm-hmm. They were still commenting what they'd seen before. But if you don't have that context, again, like you were saying, if you think that jazz has gone away and suddenly you hear something like David Axelrod using jazz signatures in pop, you go, what is this stuff? Oh, it must be a pastiche of jazz. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's exactly what you're talking about.
Yes.
Well, we can talk about this. We'll take a break. There's so much to talk about. My guest, I think, is a real artist. She's the writer, director, creator of the films, among others, Viva and The Love Witch, Anna Billers, The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back is The Treatment. I get to talk about film art here, which I don't get to do nearly enough on this show, with, I think, someone who's a real artist and creator of the films Viva and The Love Witch, Anna Biller. We were just talking before the break about that, the way race is used. I wanted to get to that because so many of these films that we're talking about, these classic films, don't deal with race or Imitation of Life deals with race in a way that doesn't really subvert, but you do. You're referring to Viva, where there's you and then your husband who's black, and then there's this sort of like this unspoken longing she has for this black woman. To play with race in these really sort of formal, stylized ways, I think you're working on so many subconscious levels there, and you're doing so much, but the kind of visual tension you create makes people laugh because they're used to seeing these things in films that were about repression.
Yeah.
And in fact, you're using these films to comment on the kind of repression that were in those films.
Well, I don't think I'm commenting on the repression that was in the films as much as I'm trying, because those films, I don't ever want to look at them, except for the films that were overtly problematic in terms of showing race in a bad way. I like to, they're sort of, and there were many. But
tell me about this.
Right. Well, but I like to, those films are my escape because of the, you know, the beauty, like I said, the lighting and everything. So I try not to, I try not to go into sorrowful places. I really kind of think, It's more like trying to, because you still don't see it now. It's more about now. It's about the whole history up until now, including now. The idea is that you still don't see, you know, two women in a movie. The object of desire is the non-white woman, and the blonde is just sort of the sidekick. I mean, you don't ever see that really, you know.
But again, that triangle I'm talking about in Viva is, this is exciting stuff to me. I mean, but also, there's something to me subversive about the idea of working in independent film and using visual stylization. I mean, because people don't know what to make of it. Either they're seeing it for the first time or they've seen clips of it before and they think, oh, it's kind of hokey and old-fashioned because it's so vivid. But there's also, in the way your characters talk, there's a concision and a clarity in the way that they speak.
Yeah.
They're not really couching things. They're not talking around the point.
Yeah, they're kind of overtly political in a way. So I like that. And yeah, in Viva, you know, obviously my character stood out and wasn't like the other people in white suburbia. And it was never spoken. And it was never said or anything. But the best audience I ever had for Viva was in Philadelphia. It was almost an entirely black audience. It just happened because it was the neighborhood that it was playing in. And all these people came up to me afterwards and were hugging me and everything. And then I realized that maybe it wasn't so covert, this idea of kind of being in the center of everything and being the object of desire and feeling alienated within white suburban culture and some of those things that were in Viva, but they weren't, white audiences didn't notice it. You know what I mean?
Of course
not. So it was sort of like they didn't notice it, right? So, but the black audience did notice it and they appreciated it.
That must have been thrilling for you.
It was fantastic. Yeah.
And it also sort of belies this truth that audience of color don't know what to do with films like this, doesn't it?
No, I mean, they know because the alienation, that was kind of there was a comedy about the alienation. And so much of that alienation was race alienation. And then her bond with the black woman and her bond with those people in Bohemia. So Bohemia sort of includes people of color. So suddenly she went out in the world and she found
Viva is a movie about a woman who... And it almost feels like a pre-code movie.
It was very much inspired by pre-code movies. So that whole scene where I'm wearing the headdress and I'm singing at the party, and it's just like I copy that headdress from one that Anna Mae Wong wore in Daughter of the Dragon. So it was a completely pre-code outfit. And then there was a tribute to Gentlemen Prefer Blondes at the end of the film. So the references were, you know, they were to Playboy magazine and the values and the fantasies in Playboy magazine, but they were also to older cinema.
Also about women sort of claiming their sexual power and how that kind of ruins men.
Yeah, The Love Witch is more about that, but the Viva was since it is a period movie, it does take place in the early 70s, it was more about the promise. The sexual revolution promised a lot of things to women and didn't really deliver on them because it was sort of men just sort of seized that for themselves.
Yeah, well, again,
female sexuality. And we're still there. We're still in that space.
That's why I'm saying, because I think to some extent, too, it's also about women sort of coming into the sexual power and men not knowing how to deal with it. So being sort of sublimated in Viva. But I think that the sexual politics also in movies is an area that's not being mined at all.
I know. And there's so much sex in movies. And without the politics, it's kind of smutty. In my view, it's just voyeuristic. So why put sex on the screen if you're not going to have politics around it?
Yeah, but I think that, again, people don't quite make of it because your characters are so plain spoken, which is also a movie thing, I think. The characters sort of saying what they want and who they are. And people don't make it.
In movies, actually now, people more don't say exactly.
Actually, the movies we're talking about.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Forgive my imprecision.
There's a lot of subtext in movies where people don't say exactly what they want. I haven't learned how to write like that yet. It's always a thing where I start with the ideology, actually, and then I start making characters. And sometimes I have to try to, you know, sometimes the ideology comes right through the characters' mouths, and I have to try to make it a little bit more subtle. And sometimes I don't. Sometimes I like to keep it very overt.
But I think though the subtlety comes, the nuance, if you will, comes from the design and the construction, the physical construction. I mean, that offers another dimension, if you will. I mean, that gives us three dimensions. So that you have these characters who are so plain spoken, who live in these worlds that are so built around them. There is this sort of disconnect between the purity of what they're saying and the alluring artificiality of the world that's been built around that.
Yeah, and that's where I think the similarity between those filmmakers you're discussing comes in, like between Pasolini or Dreyer. It's because what it is it's like you're taking something extremely important and extremely personal, and then you're taking it and making it into art. And it's like it's the translation into art, you know, which makes it distanced and kind of safe. Like you can say it through art. Things that are there would be way too ugly to say directly, like really say without subbing in it. So if it wasn't lit that way and didn't have that color and you were saying those things, it would just be sad. And maybe it wouldn't be very artistic, and maybe it would just be, you know, so like the new movie that I'm working on is about domestic abuse, but it's all through, you know, the Bluebeard myth. So the idea is that, you know, it's a fantasy, it's a fairy tale, it's a myth. So again, it's all sublimated through, you know, melodrama and thriller and color and, you know, so it becomes fun. It becomes a catharsis. And that's really, I think, what art is, right? It's like you take, you know, human experience and you transform it through art and through poetry.
But I was aware of the certainly I thought that she might be Latina just because of her coloring.
Yeah.
And the way you light her, too. And also that idea that in both of these movies, that the lead character has been someone who's kind of exotic to what we like call the mainstream gaze.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And I think, you know, it's interesting because I auditioned a lot of actresses for that part, and I auditioned all kinds of actresses, and she was, I just found her to be the best. But the white actresses did have some kind of, I don't know, sense of entitlement about them in their acting that was not something I wanted. Like, I wanted that sense of something other, like some vulnerability or something that wasn't, like, I didn't want any kind of smugness or sense of, I am superior, I am the beautiful white woman, or I don't know, I just couldn't, it was an acting quality that I was looking for, and I found that casting someone Latina, that she had that quality more than the white actresses, and I actually didn't know she was Latina when I cast her, because she looked, you can't tell, she told me when we were talking afterwards, but it was a quality that she had partly because her mother is from Colombia, and she has this dual culture.
Living in two worlds, which is interesting because it's what your two protagonists are in both Viva and in The Love Witch, aren't they? And so many of these movies we're talking about are characters who live in, who are caught between two worlds. I mean, we could look at something like Belle du Jour, or we could look at,
Belle du Jour was huge influence on Viva. Love Belle du Jour. But then he's another filmmaker who uses humor and absurdity in his stories and in a way that I really respond to, that I relate to, and I try to emulate sometimes. So some of his movies about terrible, terrible husbands, like his movie Elle, is very inspirational, or The Criminal Life of Archibaldo de la Cruz. Those are very, very inspirational for my next script that I'm working on, the Bluebeard movie.
I was even wondering about Mouchette for Bresson.
Mouchette, wonderful, beautiful. But that's, you know, that's so sad, and it's so stark compared to my style.
But,
you know,
but
my style is a little bit more Buñuel than it is Bresson. But you know, I love Bresson, and I love the stillness, and I love the.
But that's why that stillness and formality of that,
the pageantry,
and
the stillness and the pageantry, and in a way, the spirituality is something that I'm always trying to capture that spirituality. In cinema,
that thing that I guess certainly Dreyer talks about, sort of Bresson actually talked about looking for a soul. I mean, that's sort of looking for something bigger than yourself, which is something through love. Both of these characters are looking for a kind of a spiritual completion.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. And also, Bresson liked to speak of his actors as models.
Well, he often cast people who couldn't act. But they're often camera subjects.
Yeah.
And certainly if we go back to Arabian Nights, that's what Pasolini did, or even Acatone, he cast these people who just took to the camera. And that's clearly something that you've done in these movies.
I have done. I'm trying to use more professional actors now, and I think I'm actually getting a little more out of them because it's so much more work usually when you have inexperienced actors.
It's funny because we're talking about the way Bresson used the medium, because he didn't want actors, because actors just got in the way as far as he was concerned.
Yeah, well, actors sometimes do get in the way. That's true. Well, I mean, it depends on what you're trying to do. Like, if I was Bresson, you know, the last thing somebody like Bresson wants is his actors to be acty, you know? Which is why I play, one reason I played the part in Viva was because, you know, there are all kinds of reasons, but one reason I played it was because I knew that I could, I didn't want someone to be acty. And I said, how do you cast somebody in the lead role and tell them to do nothing, absolutely nothing? So that was my plan, was to do absolutely nothing. And, you know, just be in this movie and just respond to what people were giving me and just be kind of out of it and just sort of surprised at everything that was happening, but not to really feel like an actress and not to try to give a performance. You know, so that was my strategy for that. And I felt it was important. I thought, how do you cast an actress and make her the lead and make her in every scene and tell her not to act? And I thought that would be so difficult that I would just, it was just much easier to do it myself because I know how not to act.
One of the things I wanted to mention, too, is as someone who's a soundtrack collector, I basically probably have all the records that you use.
Oh, really? Well, the wonderful thing about that soundtrack music is because it was written to go over scenes, it has the same kind of rhythm. It goes with cinematography. Now, most of the music that you might use over a movie that's already found music doesn't have those kinds of rhythms and beats. And it's exciting, but it stays under the action. And so some of those composers, they really knew how to do that. They were so skilled at it. And I've tried to use composers, and composers that I've tried to use have not had those kinds of skills to do that. It's a very unique, specific skill. So Morricone had this skill to write. So there's this amazing thing, like in The Love Witch, there's a scene where she starts seducing Wayne in his cabin. And there's music that starts, and then, you know, the music changes when they go into the bedroom to make love. And it's a very long sequence. It's like 5 minutes, the whole thing. That's one piece of music. And you know that, right, because you know the music. So the thing is the music, the way it shifts and changes and does all of these different things, like that, it just laid it on top of my edited scene.
I have to ask you, what it was like for you the first time you were in the audience for both these movies being seen?
Well, you know, every one of these films, you see it with an audience, and the audience is just astonished and flabbergasted and shocked and entertained. They're laughing, but they're weirded out, and they're sort of in a daze. My boyfriend says it's like those cartoons like Tom and Jerry where you hit the mouse on the head with a mallet and there's stars. And so it's sort of like that, you know, so they're like battered mice coming out of the theater. I've always had that with all my screenings.
But the movies are, I think, what people are, what you're talking about, that sense of, and because of the sheer luminosity of the color schemes that you use, there's a thing that, and Louis B. Mayer once said this, that, you know, people don't come to movies to see real life. They come to see movies to see what their lives should be like.
Exactly.
And that dictum seems to be something that you've taken to heart in all of your work, isn't it?
Yeah, and I want to see movies where I can cheer myself up, too.
That explains everything. Thank you for doing the show, Anna. Really, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Such a pleasure.
Completely my pleasure. The movies are, they're both available on home video or streaming or wherever you live on the planet that does these services, Viva and The Love Witch. I will see you a short trip to the Ink Beast just to complete my education here. Let me thank our recording engineer here at NPR West, Peter Slasso. The show is mixed at KCRW by Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. I'm going to get myself some really colorful clothes. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.